This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to The Informer, Joy 94.9's nightly news and current affairs program, and your link to the stories that matter. We are committed to bringing you the day's most important news and current affairs stories from an LGBTI perspective. If it matters to the LGBTI community, we will cover it. We want to hear from you. Join the conversation, SMS 0427 Joy 949 or email on air at joy.org.au or follow us on Twitter at The Informer Joy.
We've seen religious organisations which lost the marriage equality debate in the United States turn their attention to attacking trans and gender diverse community people. I want to highlight tonight how vulnerable my community is to further attack and examine what the outcome of more hateful but unfounded attacks might be. The last 3 months have seen an unprecedented attack on trans and gender diverse people from opponents of marriage equality. In Victoria, we experienced some of this during the parliamentary debate on birth certificate reform, which was defeated in the Legislative Council late last year. I endured hours of listening to an unfounded scare campaign on the evils of being trans and gender diverse, and us daring to want birth certificate laws which enable us to correctly describe our gender identity on our birth certificates, without forced divorce and without forced sterilisation. I'm a proud trans woman and have made a success of my life. I've been happily married for 45 years. I've had a successful corporate career, and I was the first trans person to co-chair a government task force in Australia. I was inducted into the Victorian Honour Roll of Women earlier this year. And yet, I would choose not to be trans if I could. My life has been hard in a binary world. Fortunately, we're not all the same, and I just wished extremists would recognise that differences occur naturally and should not be seen as a threat. You do not choose to be trans or gender diverse. It's just too damn hard.
It's Monday, the 20th of November. Welcome to The Informer. I'm Lara Dickinson.
And I'm Dylan Joel.
The audio you just heard was Brenda Appleton speaking at the What Happens After Yes community forum last week. And you can listen to a podcast of Brenda's speech and others via The Informer podcast page on the Joy website.
Today is the Transgender Day of Remembrance. And on tonight's show, we'll be looking at what that exactly means as we speak to members of the trans community and what this day means to them.
This is The Informer on Joy 94.9.
Transgender Day of Remembrance was established in 1999 by Gwendolyn Ann Smith following the murder of a fellow trans woman, Rita Hester. It's a day to remember all of the people we lost throughout the year because of acts of transphobic violence, to grieve as a community and to strengthen our community bonds.
There are already over 100 transgender victims listed on the Transgender Day of Remembrance website for 2017. However, the actual statistics on transgender deaths are difficult to know.
Over the past 12 months, 325 people, predominantly trans women of colour, have been murdered. That's one person every 26 hours.
When talking about statistics regarding trans people, it's important to remember that many countries do not ever accurately report hate crimes, and the numbers reported could actually be much higher.
Earlier today, I spoke to Bobak Sayed, a writer, mixed media artist and community organiser for the Afghan diaspora and co-editor of Archer magazine, and we discussed trans narratives and the role that grief plays in the trans community. Trans Day of Remembrance this year comes directly after our big postal survey, Yes Vote, and all of those celebrations. How does it feel to you coming straight out of that joyous feeling in the queer community straight into a day of mourning?
I think that for many trans people in particular, the Yes Vote announcement evoked a lot of mixed feelings, because in some ways it's a giant frontier that the queer community has surpassed now at great expense to our mental health and our livelihood. And so I think it's actually fitting that a day of mourning should come after it, because it also serves as a reminder amidst all the celebration and the joy of a successful campaign that, in fact, a lot of the time, the members of the queer community who suffer the most, whose livelihoods are most greatly impacted and threatened, are trans people, and that queer liberation cannot happen and gay liberation cannot happen without the support and emancipation of trans people as well.
How does it make you feel seeing the lists being read out of the names of the people who have been killed throughout the year? It's obviously very important to acknowledge and mourn people who have died, but having the names sort of read out in this way in these really public forums can be pretty confronting.
It's quite confronting. I think there are people from all across the world, and I think something that it evokes in me is the particular realization that many, many of those names are trans women of color from across the world. And it's certainly not a coincidence that specifically womanhood is threatened and persecuted the most, and specifically the womanhood of trans women of color. So I think when I read those names aloud, something they all share is the fact that the cost of their transness and them living their truth was their life, but also that their race was inextricably tied into that livelihood.
Does it ever frustrate you that our main sort of trans celebration is a day of grief? Does that push the wrong message, or is it important to make sure that people who aren't part of the trans community can see that we do have a lot of issues in the community, and it's mostly coming from externally to the community?
Yeah, I think that's a good question, and it's something I think a lot about. One of the reasons why I appreciate there being another trans day of visibility that is complicated as well, because often trans narratives and specifically cis understanding of trans lives are steeped in accounts of suffering and death and mortality, which fails to kind of encompass the complexity and joys of transness as well. And so I think a day of remembrance has to also take into account the beauty, joy, and community that many trans people also experience, that is also central to their livelihoods.
Do you think it's hard to push that message of joy and our lives being, you know, worth living, basically, when we do sort of have misery as our overarching theme in life? I can't really think of a, you know, media depiction of a trans person that isn't steeped in misery.
Yeah, I think that's part of the problem, actually, because I think there are so many different ways to be trans, and there's so many different kind of access points and people who have different privileges of having access to hormones earlier, or who don't wish to have access to hormones and can exist happily in their non-binary identities without necessarily passing or necessarily looking or acting a certain way. So I think part of that problem is about representations of transness and how they have informed and infiltrated into the popular imagination and kind of distorted who the trans person is and how they are depicted.
In amongst all of that, in our media landscape and our just general lives as trans people, what should we be expecting of the cis people in the LGBT community or cis heterosexual people? What should we be asking them to do to create a better community space for us and to raise our voices?
It's interesting because what I've heard cis people, and I think prevailing perspectives on the matter, suggest that trans voices and narratives and histories are getting louder and louder and taking up more space than ever before. I think that's just true to some degree, but I think what that truly represents is that slowly trans people are taking up the space that they have always been denied and excluded from, and more specifically that trans people are telling their own stories and not having accounts of their lives told about them without them. And so I think, like, the idea of the trans tipping point, or that we are gaining access to services and media representations, is perhaps a bit flawed, because things that we have been telling our stories and we have been active movers and primary movers and shakers of queer liberation for decades in fact, centuries in certain parts of the world.
Well, Stonewall was kicked off by trans women of colour.
Absolutely, exactly. Marsha P. Johnson, Sylvia Rivera. I think it's important to remember those names. But what this ultimately testifies to is that trans people have been here, have been fighting, and have been losing their lives at disproportionate rates to everyone else in the queer community. But the unfortunate reality is that cis people have not been listening. And so when people ask me about what advice I can give to people who don't identify as trans, I think the prevailing take-home lesson is these people are talking and are starting conversations and are engaging in historical discourse. And what needs to happen is very simple but also very unnecessarily complex task of listening to us about our needs.
Simple.
It sounds a lot simpler than it is, you know? It's really like, it shouldn't be that complicated, but alas, harder than it sounds.
As you were saying, there does seem to be a perception that there is more trans voices and trans people around becoming more visible. But with that visibility comes a greater risk and a greater danger and a larger backlash. And we've already seen that with this year, I think, in America at least, having one of the highest rates of homicides of transgender people, particularly transgender women. Should we be looking to our cis allies to be protecting us, to be trying to find solutions with us, or does this have to be from our own community?
I think both. For cis people who have access and power of services and institutions, part of that responsibility of allyship involves stepping away from the mic and the boardroom, perhaps, and giving up those roles and positions to trans people. Also, I think visibility is a very treacherous terrain for allies to be pushing trans people into before they're ready. And I think that's an ongoing issue, is this idea that, like, visibility is the right direction. Visibility is something that all trans people need to be moving towards in order to affirm and live their true trans lives. When, you know, for many trans people, and for many trans men in particular, visibility is actually not an option, or not, well, their transness is not necessarily visible because they can pass. And so they have the privileges of providing that, sharing their transness at will, but not having it taken from them in public by people they don't choose to share it with. And so I guess what I'm trying to say is that visibility should be a step, ideally, that people elect to adopt, and not one forced upon them, especially by allies with this kind of delusion that visibility is better always, when in fact, like, as trans feminine people and trans women know better than anyone else, visibility equals danger and harassment and insecurity, as much as it means, you know, as much as it can mean living your truth as well. Something that has irked me today is someone wished me a happy trans day of remembrance.
oh my God.
And I think I'm like, it's like such an obvious faux pas, but I think perhaps for a cis listener audience space, primarily at least, it could be useful as they're like learning about Trans Day of Remembrance and trying to demonstrate their allyship, that allyship is not wishing someone a happy Trans Day of Remembrance.
It's not a happy occasion.
You know, sounds obvious. Yeah, it's not a happy occasion. It sounds obvious, but, like, you know, again, a gentle but urgent reminder, supports trans people. Doesn't look like saying happy Trans Day of Remembrance to someone and thinking you've done your good deed for the day.
Oh, wow. Okay. Thank you very much.
Cool. Thank you so much. Appreciate your time.
There is still more to come on Joy's The Informer, the news program from an LGBTI perspective.
Every trans story is different, not just from the personal perspective, but it also along the spectrum and diversity of what it means to be trans for every individual. Does this lead to cis individuals using that as an excuse to be uninformed or unaware about the trans experience? Or do we need to create better pathways for education and understanding?
Earlier today, I spoke to Shoshana Rosenberg, a trans feminine queer academic and musician, who shed some light on queer community building and moving beyond grief. So yeah. To start with, how are you feeling on Transgender Day of Remembrance?
I'm actually feeling an interesting combination of, I suppose, kind of a bit of distance from all of it. Like, we have an event happening in a few hours, but I don't really have a lot of connection to the community where I'm living at the moment, so it's kind of to the side. But also, I've spent all morning actually specifically doing research for a review on trans kids and research on trans kids, and have found some really awful stuff. So
yeah, that is unsurprising.
That as well. Yeah.
Well, one of the things that I've always struggled with on Transgender Remembrance is that we don't really have very good statistics from Australia. We don't have a sort of our own list or, you know, a real understanding of how much transphobic violence happens, because it so often goes unreported as transphobic violence. How do you...
Sure.
How can we still sort of have these days and gatherings for our community and have community grievings when we can't even really understand the depth of what we're facing in Australia?
Well, I think that what's interesting when you think about where Trans Day of Remembrance came from, particularly in like in the US end of things, is that in a lot of ways it's quite grassroots. So in a lot of ways, it isn't about the statistics, and it's so much more about actually each community grieving the people that they've lost. And I suppose in that way, you know, rather than relying on statistics and maybe like an official released list of people who've been murdered and all that kind of clinical kind of stuff, something that's like equally gruesome and clinical, I think that maybe the way that we can kind of currently engage within Australia is actually to commemorate the people that we're aware of that either died or have experienced horrific violence in the last year, and in a way to, you know, acknowledge those who've survived as well as commemorate those who've passed away because of either direct violence or because of more systematic violence and that kind of thing.
I mean, you say that it is gruesome, and to me it sometimes does feel a bit gruesome having these kinds of days where we just list off all of the members of our community that we've lost. How can we make this into a more community-building exercise and not just another trans narrative that is just miserable and depressing?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question, because there's always this kind of air of re-victimization with the way that a lot of people engage with Trans Day of Remembrance. And unfortunately, the one that I attended last year, it was to such an extent where everyone sat in silence and watched an officially released DVD that just listed all of the names of the people who passed. And to me, it was just bizarrely distant and kind of offensive. Like, you know, especially considering that a lot of this is about like speaking people's names. But, you know, it's like, how do we move beyond just kind of going, well, this is what happened, and kind of moving towards saying, well, what could potentially happen? And I would say that the way to do that is to actually think about this Day of Remembrance as part of a larger framework, I suppose. For my kind of background, I'm Jewish, and so for me, for example, the Day of Remembrance, the Holocaust Day of Remembrance, you don't just think about the people who passed away, you also think about what the other implications are and how each individual can actually address those aftershocks and those afterwaves. And I suppose that would maybe be one way that we can address that, is to actually use it as a way of activating.
Focus on the survivors as well, and how to try to ensure that there are more survivors next year.
Yeah, for sure. Like, as much as they're like nerdy and annoying, there's a really good propaganda quote about that, which is that on the Day of Remembrance, let us not kneel and pray for the dead, but let us stand and activate for the living to rescue those about to die. So it's like, actually, okay, well, yes, the horrible happen and people haven't survived and all that, but we actually need to use this energy not to just become inward and self-destructive and kind of individually and collectively re-victimizing, but actually also thinking about how we can move forward.
You mentioned that we do often experience re-victimization during these kinds of community grieving and mourning processes. How can we prevent re-victimization from turning into re-traumatization and continuing this trauma narrative of our community?
Well, again, I think that it's up to the tone and the way in which we present this stuff, but also the way in which we, I suppose, engage with that stuff beyond TDOR, because these narratives aren't just imposed and reinforced this one day a year. It's something that is ongoing, and that for many of us is also a reality. I've experienced this year, I've experienced at least two instances of physical violence, and, you know, like it's one of those things that is a perpetual thing in all of our lives. But yeah, again, it's actually a question of, I suppose in a way, it's actually asking yourself, well, what do you need when you're experiencing trauma and victimization? What do you actually require to heal? And I mean, for me personally, it's about community and connectivity, but also it's about that assurance of that there is stability, that there is hope, that there is something beyond this moment, this horrible moment. And I suppose maybe that's one thing that's kind of lacking with how a lot of people seem to be engaging with TDOR and also with our narrative of people who experience systematic and individual violence. And yeah, maybe that's the way to do it, is to actually talk about how do we, you know, what happens after? What's the hot cocoa to the, you know, what happens afterwards?
Do you have any idea on how to, particularly with our allies within the LGB community, but also wider allies, how do we get them to keep the rage alive and to keep fighting for us when we're aware that everybody's taking a bit of a sigh of relief at the moment after the postal survey, and a well-deserved one as well? But how can we get them to keep seeing us as important every other day of the year and keep making spaces for us?
Well, I mean, I think that comes down to like a much more complicated thing around this divide that we keep talking about, supposed divide between our experiences and the experiences of anyone who we consider an ally, a cis ally or anything along those lines. And I think that actually the way that I've found that it is best to engage with this stuff is to actually acknowledge the way in which our experiences align with and sometimes actually almost completely duplicate those experiences of people who don't necessarily fit into the same categories us. I know plenty of cis men and cis women. I know plenty of trans masculine people and people who've had completely separate experiences to me, supposedly, categorically, who've had very similar horrible experiences to me. But I feel that that's the way to kind of do it, is to actually talk about the way in which, yes, trans violence is this very specific thing, and particularly trans misogyny, but transphobia in general. But actually, my experiences are very similar to yours, and I would ask anyone who considers themselves my ally to contemplate how they respond to their feelings and their experiences, and to apply that same kind of logic to me in the same way that I try to do it with them for the most part.
Does it frustrate you ever that the main thing that people in our communities tend to bond over is our shared experiences of trauma?
For sure, yeah. And I think it can be dangerous. And I think that in a lot of situations, I think that it doesn't, you know, I recognize that trauma is a very difficult thing to negotiate, both on an individual level, let alone at a community/collective level. But yeah, it is something that seems to burden us in this way, that like it affects our media consumption, it affects how we interact with each other, it affects how we interact with ourselves, it affects how we engage with workplaces, the academy, like institutions in general. And that's a difficult position to come from. If you feel that you're on the back foot, that is a very difficult thing to then become not just resistant and reactive, but to actually become proactive and become turn it into something that is more about actually having agency in those situations. So yeah, it does frustrate me. And I often, it's not that I veer away from those conversations, but I often do try and take those conversations away from, I'm very sorry that that happened to you, to, I would love to be able to support you so that maybe this doesn't happen again, or if it does, that you feel less affected by it.
So trying to build community resilience on an interpersonal level as well.
For sure. And that's an individual practice as much as it is, I suppose, a more traditional community-based practice as well. You know, I think that it's something that we each individually engage in with how we talk about ourselves to other people and how we talk about ourselves to ourselves.
Well, most queer people tend to become sort of mini therapists just throughout our interactions with each other.
Yeah, and I mean, and that's part of also, I suppose, often being looked at as people with that level of experience, because we do experience trauma, and therefore most of us have learned to negotiate it in one capacity or another. But certainly those points where you actually admit to yourself that just because you've experienced trauma does not make you an expert in that area, but also that B, sometimes the time isn't right to talk about the trauma, and sometimes the time is to talk about other things rather than just the event that occurred and how awful it made you feel in that very moment. And it's more about what's happening now, what's happening tomorrow, what's happening next year.
And that's always important to remember, what's happening tomorrow, and how we keep making sure that we're protecting each other and acknowledging each other's experiences. Thanks so much for talking to me, Shoshana.
Not a problem.
This is The Informer, Joy 94.9's nightly news and current affairs program, and your link to the stories that matter.
Transgender Day of Remembrance is a difficult time for the trans community, made all the more difficult this year because it comes at a time when we want to be able to celebrate with the rest of the community. It's never been more important to be a cohesive group. Mourn the dead and fight like hell for the living is the Trans Day of Remembrance slogan, and we need to remember that as a community, we need to remember not just who we're fighting for, which are the most marginalized people in our own groups, but who we're fighting against. Don't forget that the No campaign was using trans people as a scare tactic, and don't forget that the government has deliberately made this postal survey as arduous and bitter and harmful as possible, and who that most negatively affects. take the opportunity now when we have some breathing room to find more ways to include our whole community in our activism. That's it for another episode of The Informer. We'll be back tomorrow at 6:30 to bring you the day's big news from an LGBTI perspective.
A podcast of tonight's Informer will be available to download soon at joy.org.au/podcast or on your preferred platform.
We'd like to thank all of tonight's guests for speaking with us, and we'd also like to thank our extended team for putting together tonight's show.
And we close tonight's show as we begun hearing from activist Brenda Appleton at last week's What Happens After Yes Community Forum.
Remember that you can download all the speeches from that community forum at joy.org.au/theinformer. I'm Lara Dickinson.
And I'm Dylan Joel. You've been listening to The Informer. Up next on Joy's Outtakes, followed by Well, Well, Well.
41% of these people aged 14 to 25 had attempted suicide. Can you believe it? 41% at age 25. 75% are being diagnosed with depression. 72% diagnosed with anxiety. 80% had self-harmed. 23% had been diagnosed with an eating disorder, and 25% with post-traumatic stress disorder. You don't go through that if you've got a choice. These mental health impacts resulted from 89% experiencing peer rejection, 74% bullying, 69% discrimination, 66% lack of family support. And 22% had experienced accommodation issues and homelessness. All of this in a medical and a health system not trained to understand the gender identity issues faced by some 3 to 4% of our population. I struggle to believe these statistics. And yet, from my own experience, I know it's true. Things are so much better than they were 15 to 20 years ago, and yet these people's needs are not being met. Do those that deny people can be trans and gender diverse really think we choose to be different? Would we put ourselves through this hardship on a whim? Of course not.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.